Welcome back to the latest episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Today I am alone because I am talking about one of our books that we're publishing through our publishers, Ebernia Books. This is a poetry book called Wild Bird by an Irish writer called Art O'Donnell. And yesterday we were lucky to launch this book in the Secret Kingdoms bookshop, which, as frequent listeners of the show will know, is a frequent collaborator for us. And we've enjoyed many events with David, the shop owner. And the previous week, we launched in La Independiente Libreria, or bookshop, in La PS, our Spanish book, La Crater en la Vida, or Life in the Crater, which Maria, my longtime companion on the podcast, will also talk about in a separate episode. Fantastic. Well, here we are. Let me explain a little bit about the event yesterday. We are also fortunate to enjoy the collaboration of Jonathan Deuma, a prolific poet from Gibraltar, and who has been a mainstay in the poetry slam scene both in Madrid and Spain nationally as well, which shows a little bit about what Ebernia is. First and foremost, it is a editorial or a publishing company, but also it's one that looks outwards towards collaborations with other creators, writers, poets, and whoever else is of an artistic mindset. So Art couldn't join us in Madrid yesterday. He lives in Ireland. So what I wanted to do today was maybe go through some of the questions we asked him, elaborate on some of the philosophies and ideas we can find in the book, and we'll take it from there. So first of all, like many an Irish person, like many an English-speaking person in Madrid, Art is, he was a teacher when he lived here, and I'm a teacher as well. Of course, I teach ESL, formerly TEFL, so basically English as a second language, to the great and the good of Madrid. And pre-pandemic, it was quite common for teachers to move around to different classes and basically spend most of their day riding the rails, which, if we were American, we could turn into something very romantic, that notion. But we're not. We're Irish and more cynical. But we do find the beauty in the movement because, of course, birds also move quite a lot. And birds are a huge metaphor in this book because, of course, what do they represent? They represent freedom and they represent movements. Jonathan Franzen, when he wrote up, he writes about birds quite frequently. And he, in one of his books, he said that birds are intriguing because they fly above us. So they're there, but also inaccessible. And in that space, in that dichotomy, lies a lot of interest on our part in them. Perhaps primarily, as he puts it as well, because birds do not pay attention to us. Now, Art, his name is linked to birds. I guess there's a personal motivation for him there as well. And I think, you know, he has used, in the introduction of the book, he talks about using an app on his phone for detecting bird sounds. So all these incidental details, you know, basically this is to say that he is surrounded by birds like all of us are, and our interaction with them can vary on a day-to-day basis. Now, I asked him this, or I was asked this on his behalf yesterday by Jonathan, and I focused in on the movement to start off because it can be quite depressing when you're an ESL teacher moving around all the time. You know, and that really hit home for me when I actually had to pop in to an office that I was teaching in pre-pandemic. In fact, I still have these students. They're a wonderful bunch. I've been teaching them for 6 years. But for some administrative task, I had to pop in. And, you know, it was good. We saw each other for the first time in 2 years, essentially. We'd seen each other via the screen of the Zoom meeting, but not face-to-face, which was quite strange considering that the previous 4 years, the 4 years before the pandemic, we did see each other every week, twice a week, on, you know, face-to-face. So, you know, we met each other. They made fun of my hair, which post-pandemic, I was very long and it took me a while to fix that. But thankfully now, 2 years after the pandemic, I think I have a handle on the whole haircut. But I did feel, even though it was a friendly environment, weird walking into the space, because fundamentally that space is not your space. And I always felt, even before the pandemic, I always felt I got a bit of a buzz from teaching in an academy, you know, which I hadn't done for a long time anyway, but it's your space, it's your demarcated teaching zone. And when you're this interloper walking around, you know, these different offices, you feel like you're intruding on a space that isn't really yours. So I'm quite comfortable personally teaching online now, because it's more of a neutral space. And it's also more practical, because as a writer or an editor or a translator, whatever it would be, you know, I'm not wasting time in the metro. I can be more efficient with my time. But, you know, there's plus and minuses to everything, because when you are walking around on the metro, sometimes you see life unfolding before your eyes, or you're listening to a podcast, or you're just very happy to be on a particular street at a particular time of day when everybody else is stuck inside their offices. So, yeah, I think it's probably not a sensation that's just mine. I would say that a lot of people would feel this way. And I think as well, when you are moving around, it can be a bit, you feel like you've no space, and teaching itself can often be very, maybe, I don't know, it doesn't always fulfill your creative urges. So a lot of teachers would gravitate towards music or something else to fill that space. And I think this is where this book for art was generated. The genesis of this book was just kind of walking around, being on the street, moving constantly, and also having time to kill. And it all came together in this confluence of creativity and inspiration. And of course, when we're talking about movement, we are also talking about immigration. And he is an immigrant, or he was when he lived here. And there are so many ways to interpret that, of course, because as a migrant, you move primarily from one country to another. But generally speaking, you're also moving on the street quite a lot, looking for a house or a job or opportunities. And as we mentioned, in the case of arts, and myself and other teachers, that did involve also moving from class to class. And, you know, the bird movement is usually dignified. There's a purpose to it. And it happens in its own time, in the time that it's supposed to happen in. While, you know, I can remember finishing a class in one part of the city and then trying to rush to another part of the city, and it's undignified, really. You know, that might sound maybe precious on my part, but when you're rushing around like that, like a lunatic, it's kind of undignified. And then also you have the practicalities of you're rushing to a class, maybe you haven't eaten, you're bursting for a pee, and you have to, you know, basically go into that class and teach it. And then if you do relieve yourself in one of those ways, you're doing it on somebody else's property as well. I mean, well, this is a bit of a tangent here, but I mean relieving in their facilities, not actually just against their outdoor wall or something. Well, this is going off the rails a little bit, but let's bring it back. So I think in that kind of grim reality of moving around, birds are definitely aspirational. But I think also what is the strength of Wild Bird is that it's a very grounded book also. Because we can have flights of fancy. And we do use birds in our linguistic, you know, areas to describe high notions, you know, or extremes of personalities. Away with the birds for somebody who is maybe quite distracted or in their own worlds. Or for the birds would be a variation of that. But, you know, there are moments in this book that are not epic. For example, is a poem he writes, which I will read at the end of this podcast, where he talks about being sick in Madrid, and he has gastroenteritis, which in Spanish is gastroenteritis. A lot of these illnesses or conditions, they actually are pretty much the same in both languages, minus an inflection or an accent or a certain pronunciation. And it's quite striking because he describes, you know, working far from where he lives. He had to take two trains to get home and a metro. It's like 90 minutes. And he is shuffling and stumbling across these different modes of transport over this span of 90 minutes. And it's quite a moving poem because it is kind of satirical. It's ironic, you know, in many ways. There's some nice images there. He talks about his walls being white as any high wave swell. But just that little thing of being in another country and being sick, you know, because if you're at home, you know, somebody can make you chicken soup. Somebody can go to the pharmacy. The doctor, you already know the doctor, and you're speaking in your primary language while in another country, navigating that in another language with a doctor you haven't established a relationship with yet is quite difficult. And it is, you know, a challenge you have to navigate because you don't have any other recourse or other alternative, really. We've also touched a little bit on the idea of immigration, and that is something that runs through this book as well. What I find fascinating, because I've experienced this as well, you know, Art and myself and other Irish people I've shared Madrid with have been of a certain generation, primarily born in the late 80s or, you know, growing up in the 90s and experiencing the transformational change that Ireland has undergone. And I have no idea what Ireland was like in the 60s or the 50s or the 70s or even the 80s. You know, I mean, I have an idea, but I haven't lived through them. And you get a sense from speaking to the older generation of Irish people that they wanted to get out of Ireland full stop and never look back, which has never been, for example, my attitude. I love going back and I love Ireland. So my relationship with Ireland is quite different to their relationship to Ireland. One guy I do know, he is almost in his 60s, and he just, you know, disliked Ireland because Gay Byrne was king. Whatever Gay Byrne said, everybody followed, and he just didn't like the general culture as well. So you have these curious references as well, to an Ireland that doesn't exist anymore. And what else is a poem but also an opportunity to migrate through the past and explore different things, because the past is another country as well also. And I think we can also talk about what, you know, there is perhaps a search for meaning in the book as well. But again, you know, there's not really anything concrete found in the book. No spoilers there. Because life doesn't happen like that. You know, there is a certain, I think, symmetry in the lives of birds, which is quite beautiful. Because, for example, certain songbirds, if their natural song is disrupted, perhaps humans intervene and they don't learn from the rest of their flock, a new song will develop. But over generations, there'll be slight modifications, and the progeny of the progeny of the progeny, the great-grandchildren of that bird whose song was interrupted and who had forgotten how his forebears had sang, you know, his or her grandbirds will kind of recover the original song of their species, because it's encoded in their DNA. And I guess there are certain aspects of that in human culture that exists as well. If you ever wake up with the nightmare of falling, that's because we used to sleep in trees, and falling from a tree was very dangerous, so it was always important to wake up before you hit the ground. So there are traces of our universal culture, I think, in our behaviors and beliefs today. Like the phrase touch wood. We say that now without really knowing where it comes from, but the ancient Celtic people would touch wood because they believed their deities and gods lived in trees, and it was as a way of getting good luck. But in a broader sense, there is a symmetry in birds and their lives that doesn't really exist in human culture. And I think that reflects, that is reflected in his book quite nicely. In fact, he's very influenced by a certain style of movie making. There's one in particular, which I've written down here in case you can hear some paper rustling. And it is... Yes, that movie was The Mirror by Andrei Tarkovsky from 1975. And there's a very famous scene there where a barn is burning. So you might be familiar with that movie because that's a very iconic scene that I think a lot of people have referenced. But essentially, this style of movie making leaves everything pretty much open-ended, because while traditional movie making would have a three-act structure, a beginning, middle, and an end, or a conclusion, life very frequently doesn't happen that way. And I think, there's a lot of humor here, as I mentioned, but also there is, I think, an appropriate side to that humor, because very often when we talk about nature, there's a glorification in nature, and people who speak in documentaries about them, who narrate those documentaries, speak in hushed reference. Here we can see the antelope and things like that. And something that we also explored in our novel La Vida en el Cráter. You know, it's very easy to fall into this deification or this extreme celebration of the beauty of the universe, which of course should happen. But, also there's other aspects of that. And the same with birds, because, and nature in general, while nature is beautiful and glorious and for sure we don't want to take away that, but there's also other elements to nature, like farce. In fact, I used to work with a vegan who wrote a book about being a vegan, and she used to work with Ray Mears as well. And one of the common things she liked mentioning in the book was how she used to do her business in the woods, because people always asked her about that. We find that fascinating for some reason. But she also mentions in her book she once saw a deer slip in the mud and fall completely on its behind, and she thought it was hilarious. And because these things do happen in nature, there's clumsy animals, chaos reigns, and it's not always epic. So I think in that sense, this is also a very grounded poem, or a very grounded book of poetry. And I've immensely enjoyed reading it and presenting it yesterday in the Secret Kingdoms bookshop. Now, before we finish, I would like to read, just throwing away my notes there and pulling out the book, Wild Bird, Art O'Donnell, Hibernia is the publisher. I would like to read three poems from him, which I think are quite nice. And this is the first one. It's called Petitions, which is set on the Camino, the way of Santiago de Compostela, which again is another avenue through which people travel and migrate under the banner of so many diverging and differing motivations. So here it is, Petitions. In a crisis, Irish people light candles, drawn like moths to the promised wisps of Santiago, in the shadow of Ferdinand and Isabella. We flew to Compostela to confide our bereavement to the saint, and the loose troubles that jingled like coins in the church box, offerings of the locals and of those unburdening themselves of spare change. A ragged German pilgrim met us after our waxy luminescence, begged for a euro and got it. He thanked me by saying, "Damn, man, you need some sun. You're like a ghost." I would have asked for my donation back, but karma interceded into this Catholic affair, I thought, by punishing us for not walking. So yeah, this is a poem, I think, that has elements of humor, and again shows the chaos of everyday situations, because again, this is a sacred pilgrimage that people often do to find some direction in their lives. And here we have this casual exchange between a ragged beggar, and this kind of light ribbing and annoyance of the narrator as well. And the irony as well, because they actually did fly to Compostela, which you're supposed to walk, or at the very least do on a bicycle. And I've even heard you can do it on a horse. But flying directly there is a big no-no. Now, our second book also concerns itself with what is the past. And in this case, it's quite interesting, because he goes back to Ireland in this poem for Christmas. And, you know, when you're in Spain, when you're in your work mode, you have your keys in your pocket, you have your wallet, you have a certain weight and presence, weight in many different ways of responsibility, but also the physical weight of the things you carry with you. Why, when you're at home on holiday, you leave your wallet perhaps back at the house. You don't have your house keys for your apartment in Spain because you don't need them. So there's a difference there, a subtle difference in how you carry yourself, which represents so much more. And this allows an avenue of comparing two different countries, in this case Ireland and Spain, but also the country of the past. So a lot of things are happening here. This is called Full Pockets. My pockets are full with being empty. The golden key sits atop a row of books, while the key rings compete with jacket sleeves for relevance. My wallet reposes with papery skin, creaking like that of a lizard, carved by the elements, ridges, edges, folds of a life, divested of its contents, pools of coins and notes clinging like ties, pouring forth across credit card holders, over the thin lips and tongues, dry 50s, somber 10s, to the hanger-on yaveros, the shelled ideas. My legs take more than a minute to adjust to the redefinition posed by my trousers. 2 weeks a year, I am the nowhere man. The town hasn't changed in 200 years. Pictures from this book, local history, like the parish priest or that one neighbour that was old when you were young and is still old, with purple hair, boiled sweets, her kitchen is where you learned the word, linoleum. Local history is nice, full of the kindest phrases. Big Tom is looking well, and the shop has been in the family for years. Tinkers vomiting and shouting. There was a green bottle on the statue. 49 of imported piss airbrushed from the pages, picked up by high-vis men on their rounds. 2 weeks a year, I do my own rounds, and I reacquaint myself with hazy figures, and all the best ones with backs covered, by luminous jackets, shovels at hand, sorting the past. Okay, well, now we have time for our final poem of this podcast, and it's called Royal Walk. So without much of an introduction, I'll just read it. Sunsets always seem pinker here, though I can't vouch for the sunrises. No flags are unfurled on the roof, and the statues that once stood atop it, now standing guard, in observation, in blankness, to the foot massage merchants and inflatable tourist traps. Perhaps Caesar's purple bursts from the clouds because there's something in the air. There's a history cycle evaporating and raining down, and we inhale it, interiorize it. It's a place where Galileo made an arse of something, and that's a compliment. where the plaza splits dramatically into two thoroughfares, where trees and Gene Kelly-free lampposts guide you to a tantalizing destiny beyond the cops with strange hats and couples walking hand in hand. But the new walkway ends here. As it starts, it literally shows a new side to the story. A regal gable is unveiled through trees from a park that is brown from redesign, fresh for planting. There is more space to walk, and the flow of people can pass through here, end their day in the Basilica de Francisco el Grande or the crypt, beg a loan from a well-moneyed Raton Perez, or find out if Carmen is as great as Bizet makes her out to be. The busker on the corner plays like Gary Moore, sings like Phil Lynott, coins settle like dandruff in his cap, and you think, nobody ever steps into the same city twice. Thank you for listening to today's podcast talking about Arthur Donnell's Wild Bird, published by Eburnea. Thank you to Jonathan for collaborating with us yesterday in the events, to David and Secret Kingdoms as always, and to you, the listener. Catch us next time.